This is Live from the Table, the official podcast of New York's world famous comedy cellar, coming at you on Sirius XM 99 Raw Dog. And on the Laugh Button Podcast Network, Dan Natterman here with Noam Dorman, the owner of the world famous comedy cellar. We have Periel Aschenbrand with us. She is a show's producer, and she's becoming more and more of an on-screen, or rather an on-air presence.
And less production, I might add, but go ahead.
What's that?
Nothing.
Less and less production. Okay.
Oh, my God.
And we also have with us the great Aruba Ray Ellen, who is one of our favorite hosts here, would you say, Noam, at the Comedy Cellar?
My speaker's not working. Go ahead. Yes, he's one of our favorite hosts here at the Comedy Cellar.
And he is also a producer of Aruba Ray Comedy, which are comedy shows in Aruba.
You don't need to. Okay, go ahead.
Off the coast of Venezuela. And he's the founder of Comedy Cloud, which is a, Ray Ellen, why don't you explain briefly what Comedy Cloud
is? Comedy Cloud, thank you, Dan. Comedy Cloud, the website is comedycloud.co. And Comedy Cloud produces live comedy shows on Zoom primarily for companies. So it's a way for their employees to reconnect and bond while they've been working remotely. And it's great. We've done over 140 of them so far.
Well, but where do you see the future of that, Ray, as the pandemic winds down?
They're definitely winding down. I actually thought there'd be no more shows, but we have about a dozen between Thanksgiving and mid-January. We have 12 so far. I mean, last year we did over 100. So if we do another 30, 40, that'd be great. And then I think it'll fizzle out eventually, sure. A lot of companies are very happy to do events remotely. They really do save a lot. They don't have to fly people in or put them up. So it's still, maybe some people, companies will still do events.
.co, is that Columbia? .co?
It's .co means .company, .corporation, .co. Comedy Cloud, .co.
That's not what .co means. Why would you say .co when every other, was it cheaper? Why did you go .co?
ComedyCloud.com, I couldn't get it. It was like $40,000. So .co has been working out just fine, Noam.
How do you know?
Because I'm getting a lot of business.
But how do you know how much you would have if people didn't type in .com and get errors?
I'll tell you what, if you want to float me the 40 grand, we'll give it a whirl.
What's it called? Comedy what?
Comedy Cloud.
ComedyCloud.com. So if I say ComedyCloud.com, I'm doing it now. Oh, it goes to it's a placeholder.
Yeah.
So, but if, I mean, .co is so obscure, I think that people will probably get this placeholder and say, oh, whatever.
That seems to be working just fine. But thank you.
Noam's making the point that maybe it would work a little better if you spent that $40,000.
Had a lot of press, Noam. We were on featured on Bloomberg Radio, CBS Radio, ABC TV. Got a lot of pressure.
Why don't you try Comedy in the Cloud .com or Cloud Comedy? How about Cloud Comedy?
How about you change the name of your club to the Comedy Basement? See how that goes.
I would take it. That's better than Comedy Bath.
Noam is back from Sin City, Las Vegas. What were you doing out there, Noam?
Cloud Comedy is available, Ray. I'm going to fill it out. I'm going to find out what it costs.
All right. How's the Vegas room doing?
Vegas room is doing not bad, actually. I'm surprised to tell you.
Why are you surprised? Everything's are back.
Well, Vegas room has been a touch and go enterprise. I mean, Vegas is a very difficult thing to, it's a very difficult market, much more daunting than I realized because, you have to promote in Vegas, but promotion is very expensive, and it's just a different thing altogether. But we stopped promoting mostly, and we're now have momentum based on word of mouth, and so that's good. That means I was there over the weekend, and Friday night the club was packed. It was just packed. I was really gratified to see that.
Wow, that's great. Considering you have a Vacacta website, by the way, your website needs a total overhaul.
Yeah, it's not working for us, is it? We're only sold out 60 shows a week.
It's not because of your website, but you think you take pride in every detail. You told me you moved the light fixture in the ceiling over a couple inches. all the lighting, you either the light bulbs, the lamps, the candles. You think you take pride in your website as well? Your website.
No, fair enough. But I've had that website, that goddamn website, redesigned so many times. I spent good money after bad. And every time we do get it designed by a professional big shot web designer, 2 years later, everybody tells me it's the worst thing in the world. So I just kind of, given up on the idea.
Can't get a chef.
Oh. Yeah. Well, so, but if you know somebody who can do a good job with a website, I'm happy to redesign it. But it's very, you know, it depends what your definition of a good website is. Like Google is not a fancy website. A lot of websites of Forbes, just came to mind, but there's a lot of very important websites, which are very, very functional, mm-hmm. and are not stylistic barely at all. And I don't think that's a bad thing. The Comedy Cellar website is very plain and it very functional. You can get the lineup and you can make a reservation. And what else do you need?
Yeah.
By the way, I'll be in Vegas over Thanksgiving week with Esty. Didn't put me with anybody that I know, but I guess I'll have to hang out with Mark Cohen and his dog. Or just hang out in my room and surf the web. But I'll be there 22nd through the 28th, I believe it is.
So I'm looking at the Caroline's website. I mean, it's, I don't know that it's, I don't know. I don't even know it's good. It's why, Ray, why are you stressing me? Get your fucking domain name together.
You're shitting on my domain name, which is going quite well.
Anyway,
and you have a website.
I looked it up. I checked it. .co is Columbia, for Christ's sake.
Well, comedycloud.co.
Well, that may be because Ray does a lot of business in Aruba.
No, that's not.
And that's near Columbia.
By the way, Dan's going to be appearing with me and Robert Kelly over Christmas and New Year's in Aruba. If anybody wants to come down,
why don't you get that .jp or something, or you know, like you could.
Well, I don't know that we need to belabor this point. Noam, did
endlessly
you see?
Fascinating to me that an adult who would criticize my website has a .co.
He's criticizing your website in response to you criticizing his website. He has no real criticism about your website.
No, his criticism of the website was a callback to a text message he sent me at like 2:30 in the morning one night.
Go ahead. So I'm just checking to make sure you're alive.
Yeah, go ahead.
Did you see Cecily Strong's
Cecily?
Cecily.
Well, whatever. Her Weekend Update segment on Saturday night.
No, was it about the Jews?
No, it was not. Okay, it was about abortion. Who saw it? Did you see it? Perry,
what'd she say?
I put it in the talking points. It would be very easy to go on Google and YouTube.
I'm sorry. I was swamped the whole day with my kids. I'll look at it right now if you want to. Tell us what it said.
Well,
Cecily
Strong played Goober the Clown, and she's talking about the Texas abortion law, and she's kind of doing it as a clown. So she's like, you know, she's spinning her bow tie and saying, you know, clown, did you know that 1 in 3 clowns will have an abortion over the course of their lifetime? I had an abortion when I was 23. Basically condemning the Texas law as a clown. Are you looking at it?
And I didn't get any talking points from you, Dan, just so you know.
Well, I sent them, but you don't look at them anyway.
I do. I usually do. That's what I was saying. I didn't know, but I thought maybe if they came last minute and I was too busy, I didn't notice any talking points. And you have a Dan Nat. DanAnatterman.com that also always kicks back is always also you guys are just awful with your web stuff.
Oh, that's true. Your email does always bounce back. I think
you didn't see it.
It's great. I think it's great. I love what she did.
Oh, you did see it. Okay. Do you have anything to add to my description of it?
No, I don't. But I like that she did it, and I think that I think that it was very on point.
So I don't know whether Cecily Strong had it. It seems to me, and I couldn't find this out, whether she had an abortion in real life at the age of 23, but that seemed to be what she was getting at.
Okay.
And that she, I mean, is that how you interpreted it?
I would imagine so. But I mean, I think she's also making fun of.
Well, yeah, I know that. But she had said that as the clown character, she said, I had an abortion when I was 23. I'm guessing that she means that she had an abortion, Cecily Strong.
Dan, I don't know if you know this. You must know this. A lot of women have had abortions, Dan, probably more than half the women.
I understand that, but very few go on Weekend Update and talk about it.
Well, they can't get on Weekend Update, yeah.
But the point is her sketch on Weekend Update has you know, gone viral or whatever you want to call it, or has, you know, become a talking point.
Dan, so, try to talk interesting. Ray's too busy checking his text messages. Maybe you can say something.
No, I'm trying to find the video, but no one told me to watch the video, so I haven't watched it until I'm pulling it up now. No, that's where.
Yeah, well, she said, well, the Goober the Clown said that one in three clowns. She kind of, it was like the Smurfs, where everything is Smurfy and Smurftastic. So she was saying, like, you know, Clown v. Wade legalized abortion in 1972. So she kind of like used the word clown, like in the Smurf sense of the term. So she said one in three clowns will have an abortion. Anyway.
What do you think of it? You thought it was well done?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people said it wasn't funny. I thought it was funny at moments. I mean, I don't think funny was necessarily the goal, but I thought there were moments when it was funny.
Did you think it was ladylike?
I wasn't thinking of it in those terms. You know, it was a rant, basically, in clown form. Which, I mean, we've talked about abortion on this show. We all think it should be legal, but not necessarily for the reasons that many people think it should be legal.
What does that mean?
Well, people make the point that it's all that women should have the right to choose without regarding the other life that is
and we actually believe men should have the right to get out of hot water. So, but it's all right as long as it works out.
We believe that.
Who's we?
Well, me and Noam primarily. Okay. We
don't believe women should have the right to choose, but we do believe men should have the right to get out of hot water. So it amounts to the same thing. I thought that was funny, but I guess not. Go ahead.
What troubles me in regard to Texas is I'm pro-choice, but what kills me is when I see women posting things saying it's so heartbreaking that men in Texas aren't letting women decide. There's a lot of women that are pro-life in Texas, and if all women in Texas were on the same page and were all pro-choice, this would not be happening in Texas.
The women who are pro-life, who don't think that abortion should be legal, don't need to get fucking abortions.
Sure,
that's how they feel.
Yeah, right? But I don't need an abortion either, and I'm pro-choice.
Right.
So it's like if all women were on the same page, this isn't happening, and it's crazy to me that a woman would want to tell another woman what she can or can't do to her body.
And
it's unbelievable.
Aruba Ray has said to me, and this is very hard to believe.
Would you guys stop? Go ahead, Dan. Go ahead.
What? Well, you're about to interrupt me with something.
Because it's so frustrating. Can't you guys who are pro-choice, I'm pro-choice, can't you have the intellectual depth to understand that when you say a woman can't tell another woman what to do with her body, that is a totally disingenuous way of portraying the argument of the other side. It's not to them about telling a woman what she can or can't do with her body. It's about telling a human that they can't kill another innocent human. That's the way they see it. Now, you can disagree with them, whatever it is, but if you're just going to avoid their argument and cast their argument as something stupid and then pat yourself on the chest and say, I vanquished that dumb argument, and pretend that there's not a much more complex, difficult, very difficult, super difficult argument, which you're pretending doesn't exist, but does exist, which you couldn't even take it on if you had to. Explain to me why one day it's alive and the next day it's not. Why one day you go to jail for the rest of your life if you kill it, and the day before that it's telling a woman what to do with her body. It
no,
is such a complex issue. It's so frustrating to me. Abortion is a hard issue. And if you don't have an answer to the tough parts of the issue, then you know what? You don't have an argument about abortion.
It's
not about telling a woman what she can do with her body. Because
we tell
women they can't be prostitutes. Go ahead.
My answer is that every time we have this fucking conversation, you focus on like the infinitesimal percentage of third trimester abortion.
No, I'm talking about second trimester abortion.
One day it's a baby and you go to jail for the rest of your life, and the day before it's an abortion. I mean, we've had this conversation. The vast majority of abortions take place in the first trimester.
Ariel, at whatever day we're gonna decide as a society that this is no longer legal to abort. And whatever day we make that decision, it's a random day. And it is tough to swallow that the day before that, the hour before that, it was nothing. And now
nobody
it's a life sentence.
It was nothing. What about like people who are raped by their fucking fathers and uncles? I mean, it's like
we've had this discussion so many times before. I do want to address the issue that Ray Ellen claims to have never gotten a woman pregnant. Which, does anybody believe this?
Yeah, because he's probably shooting blanks.
Huh?
I could be shooting blanks. You're right.
You definitely are.
Oh my God.
You know, Noam and I had the same urologist. Total coincidence.
Oh, come on.
We really did. Total coincidence.
and well, then how do you think I know you were shooting blanks?
That's right. Maybe he told you something that he didn't tell me. But we never got the same urologist. He was about 6'6" black man. He was a terrific urologist.
6'6".
How tall was he?
He's like a normal height, like 5'11", 6 feet. He's not super tall.
He seems
6'6"
to me. Well, maybe I was always laying down or I was on my knees.
Ray Ellen sees a black man and assumes that 6'6".
No. Jesus, anyway, he was a great doctor, and then he left.
Gary Goldman is 6'6". You remember him being as tall as Gary Goldman?
I kind of do.
All right. But listen,
Arnold, if you go to an African-American urologist, you're very confident with your manhood.
I guess.
That's a racist statement. You're responsible for.
Good You're talking question. About Noam?
Yeah, of course.
Noam is responsible for some number, but he's pro-choice, but he is more nuanced in his analysis.
I've said this before. I'm pro-choice, but if you put a gun to my head, I can't really tell you why, because science. The liberals say follow the science. Well, what exactly is the science that tells us that a four-month-old fetus is not a human?
That's not the only thing we're talking about, though.
It's usually morality doesn't proceed. That's usually the threshold question of any morality. Are you taking an innocent life? And generally, when the answer is yes,
12-year-old girl gets raped by her uncle, gets pregnant. What do you do?
Well, okay. I mean, I don't. People who believe, you know, in the fact that most people who believe it's an innocent life would tell you that that trumps even a 12-year-old girl. Yes, that thou shalt not kill trumps.
Thou shalt not rape.
No, it doesn't. The rape happened already. Jesus Christ, Periella, are we really this poor
Problem
logic
here?
The rape has already happened, and it point is that once there's a human life there in the eyes of the people, they would say Trump. But let's just remove from the argument the rape and incest thing, and let's just talk about the run-of-the-mill abortion at 4 months. You can't explain to me why a baby that could live in an incubator is not a human life, or 5 months. You can't tell me that.
Again, I think that the way that you're framing the argument makes it very difficult to have any other kind of conversation about it.
I blame myself for bringing
it in terms
up
of I'm framing it in a different facing the tough questions. You always want to frame it as if there are no tough questions.
No, that's not true. I just think that there are other things that you can't just take out of the conversation. And I can't believe we're talking about abortion again.
Well, it was my fault.
I told an abortion joke recently, and a woman approached me. She was like, "Hey, that's very insensitive. I've had an abortion. You shouldn't tell jokes like that." I was like, "Whoa, hey, sorry. I just told a joke. I think what you did was much worse." But, you know, either way, I'll see it home later, honey. And again, all jokes. I love abortions. I paid for two last week. I'm a fan, right? You remember? Come on. It's all jokes. A friend of mine, she works at Planned Parenthood. She loves that joke. And I was like, I might have to get rid of it. People don't like it. She's like, no, you got to keep it. I was like, I might get rid of it. She's like, no, you got to keep it. I was like, I might get rid of it. She's like, no, you got to keep it. I was like, I might get rid of it. I was like, don't tell me what to do with my body of work. She's like, every joke's a miracle.
I was really wanted this to lead more into a discussion of SNL in general, and is it funny? And which, by the way, I watch a lot of SNL on YouTube, and I guess these are the best sketches, but SNL is very funny, according to the sketches that I've been watching on YouTube. I know a lot of people say that SNL is not funny or hasn't been funny.
Professor Bloom, hello.
Would you let me finish my SNL statement? I understand Professor Bloom is here. How do you do, Professor Bloom?
Nice.
Dan, finish your statement.
Thanks for having me here. SNL was very funny.
Yes, I mean, a lot of people seem to say it's not. I watch the YouTube videos, which might be a best of, so maybe my opinion is influenced by only watching. I don't actually watch the show, so I don't know. But it seems to me, and I've said this before, that SNL at its best is so much better than any other sketch show that has ever been on television.
Yes.
Paul Bloom, professor of psychology at the University of Toronto. I have relatives up that way. Do you know the Barons? David Barron? I think he's a GI guy.
I don't. I just got here about 6 months ago.
Okay.
So, but
anyway, he was born in Montreal and raised there.
I was born in Montreal.
Yeah, I have family there too. Do you know the Burgers?
I think I do know the Burgers.
You know David Berger? He's a big furniture macher up that
we're
way.
We're doing Jewish geography here.
Paul. I tell Perry, you know, we have enough Jews on this show. It becomes too Jewish, but you're too interesting a guy to resist.
Thank you. Who would think comedy would run Jewish?
Paul Bloom studies how children and adults make sense of the world with special focus on pleasure, morality, and religion and fiction and art. And his new book out is, I'll let you, Paul, introduce the new book because my text message got cut off. But I know you have a new book out. I
good production, Periel. Good job. Go ahead, Paul.
It's called The Sweet Spot, the Pleasures Spot. Of it's Suffering about, and the Search for Meaning.
It's about how humans like to suffer.
Exactly.
Well,
the right sort of suffering.
This is a fascinating topic, and we've discussed this on this show. And Dan has, and then you wrote a column, which is, I guess, a cousin of this book about how a child... having children doesn't necessarily make people happier, right? That's actually what I got attuned to you. So now let me preface by saying I have children and it is the great joy of my life. It has made me unbelievably happy. And I had a very, very effing happy life up until then. I mean, I was living it up, okay? And I gave up a lot to have kids and get married. I was living a life, let me tell you. But I can't even... And I'm always shocked. I mean, shocked to hear people who are not getting the same gratification out of having children than I am. And I would include in that, and then I'll let you talk, my co-host or producer there, Periel, who has a single son who she loves, she adores, and he's a wonderful, wonderful, beautiful child. But yet she clearly doesn't, she feels a crimp in motherhood that I do not feel in fatherhood. So go ahead, tell us about the data on happiness from children.
Most people are like you. I have two sons, greatest joy in my life. They're adults now, very close to them, no regrets. But a lot of psychologists have argued that having kids is bad for your happiness. There are all these studies suggesting that when you parents are less happy than non-parents, there's more marital strife, problems in your relationships. And there are these famous studies by Danny Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize for his work, brilliant guy, where you get people to walk around beepers that go off randomly. And then when it goes off, you say what you're doing and how much fun you're having. And this finding, which became very, you know, very influential, is when people are with their kids, particularly with their young kids, they're kind of miserable. They say they're having fun, but when you beep them and they're with their kids, they'd much rather be with friends or in church or watching TV or socializing. And then things get more complicated. So it turns out that the happiness you have with kids depends who you are. Fathers tend to be happier than mothers. Young parents tend to get it worse. Single parents get it worse. Americans get it worse compared to other countries. America is one of the countries where there's the biggest happiness hit for parents.
That's because of lack of government or presumably because lack of government programs that support parenthood. Is that?
I don't think anybody knows for sure. That's an argument that's been made. You know, in some countries, I have friends of mine in Montreal, and they have two kids, and they take their kids to daycare, and the daycare is like $8 a day. Wow. And that makes their life easier.
So Noam is a male. He had kids later in life, and he's higher income. So those are the three things that we would expect to play greatly in favor of his happiness with children. Is that correct?
It's the perfect storm.
Perfect storm.
But you're also saying Noam might be delusional as well on some level.
Well, you know, I think there's all sorts of forces that even if we didn't want to, even if we weren't made happier, it would kind of, it's very hard for you to say about somebody you love, people you love maybe most in the world, that you would rather they didn't exist. And that's what it would be to say you regret being a father or you regret being a mother. The case I make is there are different itches that can get scratched. And, you know, in some way, having a kid takes away from your pleasure, your day-to-day fun. You know, no big surprise, but it adds meaning to your life. People say their lives are more meaningful, they're richer, they have purpose. And so there's a trade-off. If you look through everything through the lens of happiness, maybe, you know, you miss out on some of the value of having kids.
Well, Professor Bloom, when you say Americans seem to be the most affected.
You can call him Paul, by the way.
Oh, okay, Paul.
You can call me Paul, yeah.
Thank you, Dan. Paul, so if you say that Americans are the most affected, do you think it's possible that maybe Americans, and as a hypothesis, that maybe Americans are more selfish people than folks in other countries, and, you know, and they're upset when they don't get what they want to do when they want to do it, and if having a kid certainly would interfere with doing whatever you want when you want?
I don't know. I mean, the argument's been made that the amount of happiness does sort of, for a country, does correlate with things like social welfare programs and so on. But there may be other factors. I wouldn't exclude any factor. Do you think Americans are more selfish than people in other countries?
I think it's possible. I think that America, I mean, look, not to get into a conversation about vaccines, but, you know, we have them all, and there's plenty of people that, you know, are like, yeah, you know,
is there any profile? Take a guy like Ray Eleanor. We call him Aruba Ray because he spent a lot of time in Aruba.
I'm going to Aruba in a month.
Pardon?
I'm going to Aruba in a month.
I will host you.
I'll see you. Come to the comedy club there. Aruba Ray's comedy club. You'll be my guest.
I would appreciate that. I hear it's very windy.
Very windy, but beautiful. You're going to love it. We'll talk after the show. I'll give you a list of restaurants and things.
Ray will take you on a tour, too. Go ahead.
A guy like Aruba Ray, he lives a life, I don't want to say hedonistic, but he's having a lot of fun. And would you recommend, is there people that you would say, I don't recommend fatherhood to you? I think you just keep doing what you're doing.
I think that the difference between parents and non-parents is subtle and complicated. So nobody is in a position to give anybody advice, say, oh, you better have kids or you better not have kids. You know, I have a feeling that people often have a good sense of what they want. If you want to have a life of pleasure and going out and partying, kids is probably the wrong choice for you. If you feel lonely and you want sort of attachment and so on, kids could be the right choice.
What do you think about Ray having a kid in Aruba? He drops by now and then, says hello.
I can't answer it for Ray.
By the way, I heard Kahneman give a lecture. I think he was interviewed by Sam Harris, I think it was. Yeah. And he also did an interview with Tyler Cowen. But, and he spoke about this happiness versus fulfillment or satisfaction, yeah, or whatever the word. And, you know, and I don't remember exactly what he said, but I know that was a, something he was even grappling with. He didn't leave me thinking that he'd even figured it out. I know that I could look back on times in my life, which if you had spoken to me during them, I was just stressed and frayed and unhappy. And, you know, and if you had asked me, why don't you do something else? Are you crazy? I love this. You know, yeah. So it's very, very difficult to unwind what gives you happiness or if happiness is even what you're after, you know. I don't know.
Kahneman wrestles with this, and we all do. And there's, you know, there's many ways to talk about happiness, but Kahneman has a certain distinction, which is very intuitive. One is experienced happiness. So I just go up to you in a random time during the day, ask, how you doing? You enjoying yourself? You know, a buzzer could go off and whatever. And then I get a number from 1 to 10, say. And then there's, and then I sum it up or I average it. And there I figure out, how happy are you on average? But then there's remembered happiness, where I just ask you, sit down, how is your life going? And these two things tend to go together, but they could pull apart. There are people walking around who are the opposite of you back at the time, which is every moment of life is happy, but like pleasurable. But you ask them, are you enjoying your life? They say, no, it's miserable. It just sucks. I'm just a loser. I'm just, you know, having fun, but I'm not going anywhere. I have no purpose. You know, I'm going to cry now. Versus people who, if you beat every time they're miserable, I'm working hard. I got 6 kids. I got 2 jobs. I've got old projects. I'm exhausted. And you ask them, how's your life going? He said, this is the best life ever. And Kahneman's point is, which one should you try to maximize? And he in the end says, you should try to maximize your contemplative thing. Even if moment to moment it sucks, if you feel you're living good, like that's what you should try to maximize. But well, other people go in different directions.
Paul, I have a question for you. I've asked other people this question. I think it's an interesting question. If I were to tell you that I could make a deal with you and that you take the deal, and by taking the deal, you will be happy. You will be, you will be glad you took the deal.
Yeah.
You will be objectively happier when you take the deal. But you'll be a complete dumbass. You won't be a professor. You won't be respected man in the community. You won't get the seat by the Bema on the high holiday. You'll be a schmuck. But you'll be happier. Would you take that deal?
This is the most Jewish conversation ever. No. You're asking, you know, John Stuart Mill asked the classic question. You want to be Socrates, this brilliant philosopher, but sad? Or you want to be a happy pig? I won't be a sad philosopher.
But what do you attribute that to? Because I just told you that once you took the deal, you'd be like, I'm glad I took that deal. Yeah, you know you'll be glad you took the deal.
There's a real world case, no magic. There's people who have dementia, senility, where they're actually happy. They're blissed out. Some people are very anxious and miserable. Some people get senility, Alzheimer's, and they're just glowing with happiness. But who would want that life? I want to make a difference. I got family, I got friends, I got relationships, I got work to do. You know, what would you do?
Those things make you happy, by the way. Those things bring you happiness.
I would not take the deal, but I recognize that it doesn't make any sense, I think.
It's a bit of a paradox.
I should take the deal.
Because if you did take the deal, you'd never regret it.
I wouldn't regret it. Yeah.
To accept your thing, Dan, we'd all have to say, you know what, let's just admit it. Life is meaningless. and maybe it is, but it's very hard to accept that. I mean, if life really is meaningless and all this is just in our heads, then of course you should just be happy and none of it matters. And 100 years from now, no one's going to remember you. We're not cut out to face the depths of, you know, meaning like that. That's too hard to face, even though it's probably episode. True. I posed Dan's question differently at one point. I asked somebody how many IQ points they would give up to have a bigger penis, but they anyway, they didn't. They didn't
my answer to that question was my penis is fine as is.
All right. Yeah.
I've had no complaints. I haven't had a lot of reviews either. But all the reviews have been 5 stars.
Would you even miss the extra IQ points? It's kind of like that. What was that book, of Flowers for Algernon? Okay. Anyway, so and then you also you wrote a long essay, and it's related in the I think the Saturday essay of the Wall Street Journal, Why We Choose to Suffer.
Yeah.
And this is related. Can you give us an overview of that issue, because it's fascinating?
Yeah. Yeah, this is the short version of my book. You know, I hope people read my book. If not, read the article. It's just a short version. And basically, it talks about two separate things. So sometimes we suffer to give ourselves more pleasure. And it sounds weird, but that's what we do. We like spicy foods. We like scary movies that scare us, or sad songs. Some of us like BDSM. Some of us like things that just, you know, some degrees of pain. And the way our minds work is sometimes these things could trigger pleasure. They could trigger pleasure through contrast. You know, that a little bit of pain makes things feel really good later on. They could cause an escape from the self. And that's part of the argument. The other part is that, and this gets back to what we're talking about, to live a full and meaningful life, you got to do things that are hard. You got to do things that are challenging. If you don't challenge yourself, you don't run a risk of failure and disappointment and struggle, you'll be bored and you'll be unhappy. So suffering comes in for pleasure and also for meaning.
Dan, what do you think?
Well, I read the article, and I mean, yes, absolutely. I mean, we suffer, some people are gluttons for punishment for a variety of reasons, but with what you said yourself, that the suffering can provoke joy. So are we really suffering?
Yeah.
Or do we just have the veneer of suffering, but it's actually pleasure?
So sometimes suffering is just a trick to get more pleasure, you know? So somebody who, you know, goes to a horror movie and is totally terrified and it's scary and so on, but they're really enjoying it. That's why they're going. They're getting rushed, enjoying the pleasure. So that's, in some way, that's just more pleasure. But I think some of the suffering we engage in, and having kids is what we're talking about, is a good example of this, where having kids is rough, but I think the roughness of it, the difficulty of it, is one reason why we take it as so valuable. There's no activity you can do that you'd find totally easy, no problem, no stress, no worries. And later on, you say, that was incredibly valuable and important.
And what if there are just other human instincts,
yeah,
which demand satisfaction, which are not on the happiness scale, yeah, at all? We have an urge to have children, an urge to fulfill curiosities, to play music, whatever, you know, whatever it is that we find ourselves drawn to do. And isn't it possible that we might find ourselves drawn to do those things, even if it means some unhappiness? Like, that doesn't have to be a trade-off necessarily. They could both, like,
yeah,
prioritize the other thing.
You know, that's the punchline of my book. It's just, it's, you know, the fancy phrase here is motivational pluralism, which is, you know, I don't deny we want pleasure. Everybody wants pleasure. You know, it's a hot day, you want a cool drink. You know, but the idea is there's many things we want. We want meaning. We want morality. You know, sometimes we want to be good people. We want to, you know, we want bad people to be punished. We want justice to be done. Maybe we like beauty. Maybe we like truth. And you got all of these different appetites often fighting out for each other, because you can't do them all at the same time. You can't, you know, you can't lie in your butt and watch Netflix and drink beer and also visit your sick aunt who you love and you feel needs some company and also satisfy your curiosity. So it's a balancing act.
Also, how much of happiness is just your just natural state? Like, you know, not much of you can affect it. Like, some people just seem to be just born happy.
A chunk of it. You know, you want to ballpark, people say it's like 50% of the variance is carried by the genes. So, you know, you take your biological mother, your biological father, you ask each of them, how happy are you? Miserable? You're happy? You're exhilarant, have exhilaration? And then from that, you could pretty much predict you roughly. But then there's room to move around. There's all sorts of things in your life you can do to make you miserable. There's also things you can do in your life to make you happier. So it's a sort of standard balance for things. Same with things like shyness and intelligence and other aspects of personality.
Just to give you, by the way, an example, I was talking about Rayon. He's been texting. 99% chance it's some ass he's got that he's working for later.
He's still texting? Ray, stop. You're never going to be a guest on this show again.
You know what, Noam? Hey, Paul, let me ask you this question. What do you think about someone being invited on a show 2 years after the cancellation of a TV show, and that person that was invited on the show is the reason why the host of the podcast made probably anywhere $500,000, maybe $1 million on the TV show, and they were finally invited? What's the happiness quotient there?
that's a toughie.
Yeah,
that's a toughie. I'd
say that guy who made all that money is somehow not happy. Despite having all his children and well.
Noam, would you like to comment on that?
What an asshole.
I'll say that I was never made anywhere near close to
a lot of money.
$1 million. I made a few $100,000. I'll cop to it off that TV show. Why you think I owe it to you? I can't even imagine.
Never would have gotten on the air.
But if it brings you happiness, never. Right? Well, I mean, I don't want to.
Stating facts doesn't necessarily bring me happiness. But this, situation kind of brought me some happiness.
Professor Bloom is kind of here, like, or Mr. Bloom,
Paul.
Paul. Fine. He's kind of like walked into, like, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf here? Like,
it's more of a marital argument, I feel.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, Ray, I've always said that I think Ray's role was pivotal in getting that show on the air because he just did the legwork. He ran with it. But I don't want to make Paul uncomfortable with a domestic dispute in the middle of a discussion. A philosophy.
You know what's interesting? Do you remember the conversation we had years ago? You had taped Conan and we were hanging out, me, Dan, and a couple other comics. And one of the comics said to you, Dan, I don't know if you could ever truly be happy. And then he said, for example, if you were given, you got $1 million deal, I don't think you'd be happy. And you said, seriously, you said, I'd be happy for a couple of weeks. Do you remember that conversation? Do you remember that?
I don't remember the conversation, but it's accurate.
Yeah. You'd be happy. It's accurate. Short time.
Well, I think I get happy for a short time when something good with my career happens. And generally speaking,
that's the hedonic treadmill, you know, so some things will really make, you know, getting $1 million is a big deal, change your life forever in a positive way, typically. But everything feels, you know, this is actually a line from Kahneman, which is nothing matters as much as you think it does when you're thinking about it. So you get to $1 million. Wow. It's amazing. Then time goes by and life happens and we habituate. We get used to stuff. We get used to good things. We get used to bad things.
We plateau, you'd say.
We plateau, yeah. And then it keeps us striving. You know,
That's one of my favorite Kahneman lines, actually. I've when I read that, it stayed with me because it's part of a whole like cognitive bias too, that you can't try to keep perspective on things. Listen,
the truth of the matter is we're all multi-billionaires compared to anybody that lived 200 years ago.
That's right.
You know, and we're not right. And are we any happier than they are?
How often do you really feel great about the fact that you have like a toilet inside your house? You know, and you don't have to go
about 2 hours ago. I was pretty happy about that.
I mean, you make a good point because if you think of what it must have been like for the average human soul, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, by our current ideas, we would think, well, they must have been miserable. How could they possibly have been happy? But certainly they were happy. I mean, you know, there's no species that's just been born miserable. Like they got happiness out of other things. And maybe in certain ways they were happier, right?
Well, James Baldwin wrote about joy as opposed to happiness and how, you know, joy was tinged. It was happiness, but it was tinged with a little bit of sorrow. And so you were able to actually appreciate sort of the full range.
I think Baldwin wrote that white people often were not capable of experiencing joy the way black people were. That was his take on white people, that they were joyless in some way. I think I remember that. And I remember thinking that he had, there was something to what he described. I don't like to generalize these things much, but he was describing how, you know, an uptight culture of that time was contrasted to the joy that he saw black people, when they were having a good time at church or listening to music or singing, whatever it is. And I spent a lot of time as a musician, and I don't know if anybody else here is a musician, but you know, sometimes when you're playing music and the music is uplifting and you're screaming and it's just this primitive, wonderful feeling that you get. And I remember thinking after a really good night with the band, I said, you know, other people who don't play music, they never will experience that. They have no idea what that is like. And it's huge. It's a huge thing that is a potential feeling that you can have that many humans will never experience. But I think that Baldwin, and I will presume to say that like in a black church, the whole congregation will get that feeling. And I think that's maybe if Baldwin were alive, he would say I was kind of onto what he was talking about. But we're way off the subject. But I will say one of the things I had compared childbirth. So, when you throw a dog in the water, it immediately starts to dog paddle. If it never was thrown in the water, it would never trigger the dog paddle thing. And the dog would never know, to the extent that a dog can know, that it even knew how to swim or knew how to dog paddle. And that's what I felt happened when I had a child, that all of a sudden, all the dog paddle reflexes, as it were, kicked in. And all of a sudden, I looked at the people who never had children and said, well, you don't even know what you're carrying around inside you. You don't know what can be triggered in that part of the brain that will never be triggered, and the joy in that thing. So that's how I view having children, is as it opened up a part of my brain, which I really had no access to until I was thrown in the water.
I remember with my kids, it was a different kind of love. It was a whole new experience. You know, you're used to the love you have for friends and then certainly romantic and sexual love. And then your kids come out and there's just this different whole new emotion.
Yeah.
And, you know, it comes in my article, I quote Zadie Smith, this wonderful British writer, and she just talks about the terrible risk of having kids, a terrible fragility. You have a kid and then for the rest of your life, you're never at peace because you love the kid more than you love yourself. And there's this tremendous vulnerability.
You must worry all the time.
You worry all the time.
I'm sure.
You know,
I got to knock somebody out.
You still worry all the time.
I got to have a baby. That's it, Dan.
Okay.
Now, Ray, not everybody's cut out for children, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't mean this in a snarky way. It also helps. I mean, I think of all my friends who... All my guy friends who have kids love having kids. But I will say the ones who express the most jubilation are the ones that are the wealthiest, that are in good marriages, that, you know, have a lot of help you know, and I do think that factors in. I have a buddy of mine who's divorced with a kid. He doesn't make a lot of money. He loves having his kid. It's great, but he's not quite as enthusiastic as the other guy who's a big attorney with, you know, a nanny and a maid and a wife.
I think having kids when you're poor is brutal. It's just, you know, and having a lot of kids when you're poor is very brutal.
Money is clearly greases the skids, but I think there's a big law of diminishing returns with money. I don't think you need to be wealthy, but it's better not to have tremendous financial anxiety. Yeah, I mean, on the other hand, but on the other hand, I would say that if you were to maybe study like the average like Asian family living on a shoestring budget with a bunch of kids and the New York Times described like going without food just for test prep and this kind of like hyper focus on children in a poor family, they would probably answer different questions than your struggling friends, Ray, because it's just a different cultural sense of entitlement that people, your friends would have, I think. I don't know. I'm guessing.
Those people never seem happy. I can't imagine seeing that group you just described sitting around the pool laughing and frolicking.
I don't know. Yeah. Paul, you have any other remarks on that? It's very interesting.
Just that there's that psychologists keep asking people, how happy are you? And, you know, and how good's your relationship with your partner? And I think these are good questions, but they're not the only questions. And I wish people, you know, people are starting to ask different questions, like how much meaning does your life have? Do you regret your choices? What would you have done differently? Is your life full of purpose? And you get different answers. And I think this is part of Kahneman's insight. There's a lot of different questions you could ask. And when people say, my kids are the greatest joy in my life, people have been saying this here, they typically don't mean I had a hedonic blowout. It's like an orgy or like, you know, cocaine or something. That's not what you're talking about. What they often mean is that, you know, now they have a reason for life and they have these deep attachments and they feel like they're a different person. And you know, I think my field has done a terrible job in studying this. So if you look, you'd easily find 100 articles saying, you know, being a parent sucks, you know, surprise. And they think it sucks because they're asking the wrong questions.
So, you know, to go back to what Dan proposed earlier about would you give up this if you could just be really happy? And I'm being serious here. Couldn't you have the life you currently have? And isn't there medication that can make people, there is, I mean, that make people much happier, that literally lifts their mood. So you live the life you want to live, but maybe you wouldn't care about writing as much if you took that drug and felt so much happier, you know, happier.
It's a good question. A lot of there's a lot of people with manic depression, for instance, who say that the drugs make their lives better, but they take the edge off and they lower their productivity. And in some, I'm not sure how true it is. I'm actually most productive when I'm happy. Maybe I'm being a bit less ambitious, but I get more work done when I'm in a good mood. But I agree with the general point, which is, pardon me?
And when you're not like riddled with anxiety or stressed out, that makes it difficult to work.
That's right. Or simply depressed.
And it's, you know, when you're depressed. I want to try to draw something out of Pariel here, but I just want to make one other comment because I keep coming to mind and I keep forgetting it, that some people are the enemies of their own happiness. And I go through this with my wife. I had read an article at some point that said that, you know, one of the best ways to be happy was to pay people to do the things that you don't want to do yourself. So, you know, and I'm not going to do dishes. I'm not going to do housework. I'm just not going to do it. And my wife refuses to hire a housekeeper more days a week. And thank God we can afford it. And, you know, and when I was a kid, a lot of families had like a 5-day a week housekeeper who was there when the kids came home from school while the parents were out working. It wasn't even particularly extravagant thing. Maybe it's more extravagant now, but whatever it is, we could afford it. And she'll complain and complain about the house is a mess and having to clean up and do this and do that. I'm like, get a woman or a man, get a housekeeper to come in more days a week because I'm not doing it. But she just can't bring herself to do it. She feels lazy. She feels I don't know. So you have any comments on that? Like, how do I convince her to leave me alone? She's bringing my happiness down. She's squelching, throttling her own happiness.
Maybe she makes her happy to henpeck you.
But it makes her unhappy.
To save money that neither of us are going to ever enjoy. We're going to die with it in the bank probably, but go ahead.
but she is made unhappy by the guilt that she feels hiring a woman, perhaps a Hispanic woman, and your wife is Hispanic.
No, that's not what it is. That's not what it is. She doesn't care about that. It's not the Hispanic thing. It's not guilt about hiring a woman or a Hispanic woman or government, anything like that. It's that she feels guilty that somehow she feels like she should be doing this herself.
Well, did she not? Sometimes I don't know how she didn't grow up with a ton of money, I don't think, right? So maybe she feels guilty.
She grew up very, very poor. Very poor.
Maybe she feels guilty spending money on something that she thinks she could just as well do herself. I don't know. We
have unopened Amazon packages stacked up from impulse purchases that she buys. I wish she felt guilty about spending money. No, it's not about spending the money. I'm telling you, it's about not doing it herself. Anyway, it's just added to the interesting parts of human nature. So Periel, you didn't say much, and I kind of, you know, said a pointed comment about you feeling the pinch of rearing a child more than any of us. And
well, I didn't say much because last time I said something, you said I wasn't doing that much production anymore, patently false.
All right. But anyway, I mean, your son's too young. He probably won't listen to this podcast.
I did hear that you said that, and I actually I don't quite agree with how you phrased it. I think that what would be an accurate thing to say is that I never had my sights set on getting married and having children. Actually, I sort of was never really very interested in doing either one of those things. And then I always wanted to be a writer and work in comedy. And my second book came out and was published. And I was 9 months pregnant when it came out, and I hadn't been planning on getting pregnant. I mean, I guess I should have been a little bit. It's not like I didn't know how it worked. But I wasn't anticipating being 9 months pregnant when my book came out, and I'd spent, you know, obviously, several years working on it, et cetera, et cetera. And I had a really difficult pregnancy and a really difficult postpartum, and it really threw me off course. And I think it really, it took me about probably 3 years to, and maybe 4 years if you include the, you know, year more or less that I was pregnant, which was really, really difficult, to become like, you know, sort of a human again. And well, I think—
Can I interrupt you? Because just to go back a second. So, but when you found out you were pregnant at that point, I'm presuming you at that point said, I want to have the baby. Like at some point, like we talk about abortion all the time. It doesn't seem like you'd be against having had an abortion if you didn't want to have the child. I feel like
I had so many already. No, I'm just kidding. I wasn't thinking about having an abortion, but it was
because you were getting because of the abortion or because you decided I have a child
because we wanted to have a baby or we had decided. I just didn't think, I thought it would take me a year to get pregnant. I didn't think I was going to get pregnant the first time, you know, we had sex.
Oh, so you did try to have a baby.
Well, yes, but again,
That was obscure.
I was older. I mean, I was 37 years old, and I thought all my friends were like, well, if you're going to, you know, try to get pregnant, you better start now because it's going to take forever. I think the point is that your life changed significantly less than my life did.
Wait.
You and your, you know, an incredibly present and wonderful father. I'm not saying anything about that, but you, I really couldn't do anything for about 3 years, and I wouldn't change it. My son is, you know, my favorite person on the planet. And I think what Noam said is true. Like, I triggered things in me that I, as a mother, that like I never in my life even imagined. But it's really different to become a mom. I think when you have, especially when you'd never fantasized about becoming a mom, like I thought I was going to have this kid and just get back to, you know, trying to like write books. And
by the way, I just do want to agree with you that Noam is a very present father, so much so that he is ignoring the needs of the comedians with regard to the menu. Now, I am happy to report that there is a minestrone soup available as a special. So I'm glad that Noam is finally getting around to concentrating on the menu.
Wait a second. There's also new hummus and falafel balls that are
Periel. So Periel, would this be accurate? If someone were to ask you about whether childbirth, having children made you happier, you would say, it makes me less happy, but I wouldn't trade it for the world.
No, I wouldn't say that.
You wouldn't say that?
No, I would not say that. I would say that it did make me more happy.
Oh, okay.
Also, don't you think, I mean, there's a huge difference becoming a parent for a man versus a woman. Just described mood changes and I'm sure hormonal changes and physical changes.
Yes.
I mean, no, I'm just got to, you know, sit there and like, right. You know, there's my kid.
That's what I'm trying to say, though, is that it's very, very different to become a mother than it is to become a father.
Sure.
Especially, I mean, some women, a lot of women, I think, like, I have a lot of girlfriends that all they ever wanted to do was have a bunch of kids.
Right.
Well, some fathers aren't as present as other fathers.
Yeah, Noam's a very good father.
Noam is quite present, as I said, to the detriment of the menu sometimes. but we do have a minestrone soup that I'm looking forward to. It's a Moroccan minestrone, and I'm told it's very good.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I have to go because I have to go around the corner of the Village Underground and host the.
It's okay. You can go. We don't need an excuse. It's okay. It's fine. Go.
Good. Yeah. No, I really wasn't for you. It was more for Paul Bloom because I actually think Paul's a lovely fellow. And I actually think.
But Paul, you're going to be in Aruba next month. Ray's going to be in Aruba next month. Ray knows that island like the back of his hand. I really think you'd do well to hook up with
him. I would love it. Even though Ray and I have some obviously unresolved conflict, he's an extremely gracious host in Aruba, and you would be very smart to take him up on his offer to show you a little bit around the town.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Noam. Happy to do it, Paul. Great to meet you. Nice to be on here. Everybody, again, check out comedycloud.co if you'd like to do a private event for your company or a holiday event. And arubacomedy.com for all your...
Periel will give you Paul's email so that you can...
Sure, I'm happy to do it.
With Paul's permission.
Nice to meet you, Paul. Good to see you, Noam. Periel, Dan.
With Paul's permission.
Bye, Ray. Well, we're about wrapped up here as well. I don't know, Paul, you have any comments? Would you write about other things besides these kind of like psychological things? You write about politics at all? What else are you into?
No, my book before was about empathy. It was called Against Empathy. It was arguing about moral decision-making and how we tell right from wrong.
I know that book. I didn't realize you had written that book. That was a very influential book.
It got me into a fair amount of trouble. It was fun. I think some of the arguments held up.
My friend Coleman, our friend, whose name seems to come up, Coleman Hughes, talks about that book.
What's the name of the book?
Coleman, but I know his work. It's called Against Empathy.
Why did it get you in trouble?
I think because people just quickly read the title and thought I was some sort of psychopath.
What's the subtitle? There's always a subtitle.
Exactly. Thank you for asking. The subtitle is The Case for Rational Compassion.
Oh,
so plainly, you read the subtitle and you say, oh, there's something going on. There's a distinction between empathy, putting yourself in another person's shoes, feeling their pain, and compassion. I wonder what that distinction is and so on. And that's what the book is about. But sometimes people just read the title.
Yeah, people need to try to operate on principle because, I mean, this is maybe not what you're with, but empathy is such a dangerous and unpredictable and, you know, really comes, another way I see it is that, well, it comes down to whose ox is gored. That's really what happens. And it's very disturbing to see the way people are so oblivious to that.
We feel empathy for people who look like us, for people who speak our language, people who don't threaten us. And empathy sometimes makes us narrow-minded and narrow-focused and kind of mean. And when we take a broader, more principled view, that means we're using other parts of our moral psyche. And that's the sort of case I make.
And there's a humility in acting on principle, despite the fact that your emotional side is telling you otherwise. And the humility is that you realize that I'm very fallible. I'm very prone to these misjudgments because of my emotions, and principle is the only thing I can really rely on to steer me right. And in retrospect, principle, you know, 9 times out of 10 is is the best thing. Peoples who stuck to principle didn't live to regret it too often.
If I could have a billboard that says one thing, it would say, don't listen to your heart.
Yeah.
I mean, our gut feelings often they feel right. They feel we're confident in them. Often they're bigoted and narrow-minded, narrow-focused. And we do our best when we sort of say, well, I have a gut feeling here, but let's just step back and apply principle and other things.
I must say that I'm shocked that Noam went an hour without mentioning a word that he coined, which I think has a lot of relevance to this discussion, the word being indignagasm. Oh. Noam, how'd you go an hour without mentioning that?
I haven't mentioned that in years, Dan.
That's great, because you immediately know what it means.
I haven't spoken about an indignagasm in at least 4 years.
Has it been that long? But
Yeah.
No, people like being angry. People. Yeah. So that sort of plays into, you know, your idea of people seeking out suffering in some way.
There's a pleasure into certain bad feelings, into anger, being angry, being indignant, being wounded. You can sometimes savor the feeling of being wounded. And, you know, some of it's healthy, some of it's not.
All right. Well, this is the most fascinating stuff, right? This is so interesting. If you ever get to New York, please join us at the Comedy Cellar. So you know who Coleman is, right? Coleman.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I see him on Twitter. I've heard him talk to Sam Harris and other people.
So he's also a great trombone player. And he and I have a band with a few other people that we play every Monday night in the Olive Tree above the Comedy Cellar. And it's pretty fun. All right. Well, it's been a pleasure to meet you.
This has been great.
It has been. I'm happy you enjoyed it. And that guy Ray Allen, you know, I gotta apologize for him, but he resents me. I won't bore you with it. But let the listeners know he's not correct about his. He has no reason to resent me. If you know. All right. I'm gonna shut up. We have another show.
The show and really air this
out. Yeah, we should have another show where we really debate it, because I really want to cut loose on Ray Allen. And as Dan knows, I'm holding a few aces in the hole, meaning things that I've never said out loud, which he doesn't know I know about, but I might. He might drive me to it. All right.
Paul,
anyway,
might have to have you sit in on that one too.
I'm not that kind of psychologist.
In that, I just to say, I think Ray played an integral role in getting the Comedy Cellar TV show on the air. And I've said that before. Paul Bloom, thank you.
Thank you.
Where can people find your book?
I guess Amazon. I'm on Twitter at Paul Bloom at Yale. And I have a website, just Amazon. Just
at Yale, but you live in Toronto.
I do. I'm also emeritus professor at Yale. I worked there until like 3 months ago.
So emeritus just means you don't do nothing.
Exactly. Exactly. And I'm old.
I want to tell you guys something. Paul, you might find this interesting, or you could leave if you have to go. But there's a certain type of person.
Oh, God.
That no, this is really true. I've noticed this, and I think it'll ring true with other people. There's a certain type of person who feels that they are owed something in some way when they have any impact on something that happened favorable for them. So like, people, if somebody introduces somebody to somebody, I was the one who introduced you, maybe even, and people will sometimes even sue, I should have gotten a fee or whatever it is. And I think that's what we're talking about here. And I think this
are you talking about Ray again?
Well, it's a reminder. So, you know, I had the idea for the TV show, totally, as a matter of fact. And by the way, there were other people who were interested in the show. Ray knows this. Someone even overheard me. I had producers from other networks calling me interested in the show. But Ray introduced me to this one guy, Michael Hirshhorn, who actually I went with, who put the show on the air. He introduced me. I've introduced people. I'm sure I could put a number of millions of dollars in my lifetime that came from various people who met through me or introduced me or whatever. It never even occurs to me, like, because you introduce people. That's not, this is part
well, I
of,
think Ray's role was a bit bigger than that, but he's not
no,
here.
No, so. No. It was not bigger than that, Dan. No, it was not.
Well,
it was not
why don't
than
we
that.
Have him on if you want to have this out? Because I don't think it's fair because he's not here.
And to this day, it irks him. Somehow, he let it out. I was the creator. I own the club, and I made the big, I'm using scare quotes, the big money. I had the significant money, and I have no idea what he made, but he made less. And this is burning him up because in his, I'm the one who introduced him and he made the money and I did. And this is a way.
No, I don't think he begrudges you the money. I think he wants you to acknowledge the role that he played, but again, he's not here.
But I'm just, this is a formula for misery in your life. You cannot. Pettiness
is
highly associated with misery, in my opinion. Okay,
right,
so that's that.
I'm happy to tell you this.
I'm happy to have said that when Ray's not here to defend himself. Go ahead, Perry.
I want to tell you this. I am the biggest night owl. My favorite thing to do before I had a kid was stay up late and drink coffee and smoke cigarettes and write. And I hate the morning. I hate getting up in the morning. One of my favorite things in the world to do is to take my second grader to school every morning. It is one of the greatest joys of my life. So, you know, but it's hard. I think that that's really, you know, what we're talking about here is that. And back to what you said about, you know, I don't think the crimp or the cringe is accurate at all, because it's difficult to be a present, good, patient, thoughtful.
Perry, I only meant, and then we really have to go, when I said crimp, and I think crimp is the right word, what you have to deal with that I don't is that in some way there was a trade-off in your life for having a child. There are certain things that you may not accomplish, or you can't devote the time, whatever it is. There's a trade-off that you are experiencing. I experienced no trade-off, really. I mean, I had to stop hanging out, you know, trying to pick up girls, but I was getting too old for that. So I really didn't experience any trade-off. And that's all I meant by, and that's a crimp, you know, so that's all I meant by that.
So
I gotta say, could I just jump into one thing, which is about the topic. I have a friend, the philosopher, Laurie Paul, who'd be great for you guys to talk with. And she talks about transformative experiences. And a transformative experience is an experience that is a big, significant one, and it will change the kind of person you are. And from where you are now, you can't anticipate how the world will be different for you.
Mm.
And having a kid, particularly for a woman, but I think for all of us, is a transformative experience where you become a different person. You have different priorities. Yeah. And so, and that makes it very hard to kind of reason about it and figure out what's best and so on.
Nicole, does this episode make you want to have kids more or less or the same?
She's our sound guy. Our okay. Engineer.
That's our, Nicole, she does the production and the sound. Thank you, Paul Bloom. I guess we're all done.
We're done.
I think, Paul, you might be, you were probably a little surprised at the intellectual weight of the discussion, given that we're comedy folk.
No,
this
had a
great
call with him. We talked before. I promised him that both of you were smart.
My book, Iris Spiro, Before COVID, a novel available on Amazon. If you can only buy one book, mine or Paul's, unfortunately, it's got to be mine.
What about mine?
You and Paul are, you know, whatever. But you have a book, On My Knees, and The Only Bush I Trust Is My Own. These are memoirs. They are available as well on Amazon. So go to Amazon, buy Perio's book, my book, and Paul's book. But again, if you have to choose one, the choice is clear.
Oh, Paul, did you ever read, if you hadn't, this would be interesting to you, but maybe you have. George Will, the great intellectual.
Yeah.
He wrote two columns at various times. It was separated by a number of years about the gratification and fulfillment and love that he got from his son with Down syndrome. Yeah.
I read them when they came out.
Yeah. And those were extremely moving to me. And I think in those columns is some insight into what we're talking. So anyway, people at home, you should Google George Will's columns about his son with Down syndrome.
Iris Spiro, Before COVID, on Amazon, The Sweet Spot.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Well, okay.
Thank you for having me on. Bye.